Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken, it's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show with Brett and John Rappaport. Hope you're having a wonderful afternoon. I know it's not snowing, it's not 10 degrees, and there's not ice all over the place, so all is good. Unless, of course, you're working on tax returns. But that aside, again, it's all good. As usual, we've got a packed show for you. We've got a full house again. We have two guests. One is our usual Tuesday guest, James S. Robbins, who joins us every afternoon on Tuesday to discuss all the very interesting things going on in Washington, D.C., and of course, in extensive detail, that which is going on abroad with regards to national security and foreign policy. Of course, Jim has a wonderful background in that, as he teaches at some of the most prestigious institutions that cover that, and I'll let him describe those. And he is also a well-known author and columnist, whether it be the Washington Times or USA Today or all the other periodicals. And, of course, his most recent book, The Real Custer, wonderful historical perspective and detailed information on George Custer, General Custer or Colonel, whatever time period you want to look at. And he's got many other books as well. But before he joins us, we're going to have Michael Brickman, who is the Director of National Policy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. And this is something John and I had discussed just after the President had mentioned it during the State of the Union address. But the idea of free community college, another very expensive program that will accomplish next to nothing. We're actually going to get into a very lengthy discussion on that with Michael. And so we welcome you, and we, of course, will welcome our guests shortly. So, John, last week we had, by the way, Phil Kirkin on to discuss Senator Menendez and his legal issues. Just leave it at that. And the Justice Department looking into a lot of different things with regards to various improprieties. So what's interesting about that is the fact that when I look at the news cycle and what the media is focusing on, it's still nonsensical items, such as, you know, we're really still 2 years away from presidential election. And we're still focused largely on, like, almost completely irrelevant things that the 20 different Republican candidates might be saying or doing or have. Just things policy-wise which are completely, just irrelevant to or have such a low impact to anything in our daily lives or with regards to the security of the nation or the viability of the nation. And yet, some of the major things that are going on, such as corrupt senators who are, potentially have conflicts with foreign dealings and influence that could sway the security of this nation, or Hillary Clinton, I mean, all the above there, they just don't really want to talk about it. In fact, what they do is they kind of try to apologize and prop up these individuals. And it's very interesting to me because we're not going to get into this in that great of detail today, but I was doing a little bit of research, John, on some of the past things that have been said by members of Congress, and including the president. You know, they've made statements such as, you know, the president saying how it's un-American, it's unpatriotic to create such a large debt, yet he himself is single-handedly responsible for almost the equivalent of every president before him. Or Harry Reid telling us back in the 90s several things, one of which would be it's irresponsible for people to have their own private emails or cell phones or things of that nature, and there are many other things, but I'm just using a few examples here. But when it comes to a time period where someone in their party is caught doing something that may be or is wrong, they always come to the defense. And it's troublesome, really, to have a senator who, when it's good for him politically, to say, oh, no, this is bad, you shouldn't be doing this. But when it hurts their own, meaning in their party, all of a sudden they seem to forget what they've said in the past. Every single one of these people, and I will be fair here, I'm sure if we go back and listen to the audio tape of Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and many Republican leaders, they'll have the same thing. I guess the difference is that the level of corruption within the Democratic Party is simply much greater. In fact, just the thought process of people who generally subscribe to being conservative or, you know, at worst moderate, generally do not commit the same type of violations as those who simply do not believe in law and believe in the free-for-all of anarchy and radicalism, which generally and almost completely at this point makes up the Republican Party. I'm sorry, the Democratic Party, because as we could see, Barack Obama and his fiefdom have done a very good job of eradicating anything that could be considered moderate within the Democratic Party. I mean, it's pretty much just all extremism at this point. Anyway, John, I know you're going to want to comment on a few things I've mentioned before we bring on our first guest to discuss the outrageous proposal of free extended high school for people who go to community college.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, Greg. When you look at the challenges that we face, one of the biggest challenges is still governance. And you made some points about undue government influence in your opening comments. And I just want to point out, you know, we actually have right now ongoing the election in Israel. And for all the amazing amount of primarily from Democrats, primarily from Democrats who clearly do not support Israel, and many do, but we had this large block, I forget the number, but let's say it was maybe 40 Democrats who decided not to come to see Bibi Netanyahu speak. I think it's so critical to understand that there's incredible duplicity and hypocrisy in the Democratic Party. And this is not to say that it's not ever showing its face in the Republican Party, but I want to point a couple of quick things out. One, the same exact people who were so, while Israel literally is facing an absolute, you know, the utter annihilation or threat of annihilation from Iran, while we're pretending Iran is a partner for peace as well, you know, the leader came here basically to beg for our continued support, knowing that the president is going to sign a really bad deal, and he was accused by a large number of Democrats as meddling in our government affairs inappropriately, while we have numerous people from the president's past payrolls who are doing that very thing, and it is clearly showing there's a pretty decent chance that Netanyahu will not be the next prime minister, or if so, will make it a much larger challenge for him to form a coalition government, which plays into Obama's hands of trying to hold Israel to the fire and make it very difficult for them to not bend over. And I specifically use the terms duplicity and hypocrisy here because when you look at the way these parties function, the one thing I note is that, by and large, when these things occur in the Republican Party, you tend to see a lot of pressure and fast resignations, all the way up to Newt Gingrich, who, even though he was enormously successful running a conservative ticket and having an affair outside of marriage, was a lot of undue pressure, and you know, people could easily say that, you know, that was entirely hypocritical. But here we have just this. Just now, we see Illinois Republican Congressman Aaron Schock, you know, had made it public that he was going to be resigning by the end of March 31st, having faced a couple of weeks of questions, ethics questions, basically, about how he's spending taxpayer money. And so I think that's a very important, one of the most important parts of your opening, is to point out that we have a big problem in government, but the one thing that I will say, while far from perfect, and we have many things to complain about them, there is definitely a higher sense of honor. I'll just use the playful term honor among thieves, but you know, Republicans do seem to weed their own out for duplicity and hypocrisy, you know, at least to some degree, and I commend that. Anyway, I'm looking forward to having our guest speak, though, because I was at a terrific function last night from the Financial Policy Council, who's, you know, based out in New York, great organization, and they're uniquely focused on trying to do something we do on the show all the time, which is connect foreign policy and the financial stability of this country, and that the two are so independent. You can't be strong militarily and not strong financially. And there are core components that go into that. One of the most important ones, of course, being an educated public. And I'll make that my transition to our guests. You know, when they come in and join us. But there is a
yes, and John, we are ready.
So. Oh, we are ready. We're like, okay, I'm sorry.
Yep. Yeah. Without further ado, I want to welcome our guest, our first guest of the program today, Michael Brickman, who's the National Policy Director with the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, is joining us to discuss something which, quite frankly, I think is just another irresponsible proposal. But I guess from this administration, I'm not surprised. Of course, that's my opinion, not yours. But Michael, first of all, welcome to the Final Say Radio Show with Brett and John Rappaport.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I think it's interesting because it always comes down to politics and not common sense or proposals that are actually beneficial to the people that it's, you know, supposed to or that would participate in such a plan. And in your article in The Hill, you've certainly pointed out a lot of reasons why. And I agree with much of what you've said. And it's just another circumstance where the president makes a proposal. There's really no detail to it. It's expensive. It could potentially harm the Republicans in an upcoming election because, well, you know, what are they supposed to say about this? Don't help people go to college?
Well, right, free is always nice, but of course we know when it's the federal government, it's not free, it's just someone else paying for it. And with community college, it's, I think, really trying to address the wrong problem. So certainly in our four-year colleges and universities, we know that affordability is a major issue. Not saying it's not a concern for some people in your two-year community or technical colleges, it is, but the vast majority of students, especially low-income students, are able to go to community college today for free or nearly free because of all the federal, state, private aid that's out there. So, you know, I think that's really addressing the wrong issue here. I think instead we need to make sure we're looking at the fact that the overwhelming number of students in community college don't ever complete any degree. And that is often due to the fact that they didn't have enough of the core skills and knowledge they need to be successful in college when they were in high school or when they were in middle school. So I think this, in a lot of ways, goes back to our K through 12 education system. We need to go back and make sure that people who leave with a high school diploma actually have that diploma mean something beyond just a piece of paper that says they sat in class for the right number of years.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. We for years, we've interviewed a handful of the fellows at the Hoover Institute actually going over the K through 12 curriculum. And we've discussed things from Common Core to these new park exams and things of that nature. And mm-hmm. quite frankly, we do not properly prepare the students in those grade areas to come out and go into college. And what you find is so many kids are taking courses at a lower level to catch up. And so how many of their dollars in a four-year college or how much time spent in community college is really, you know, a continuation of high school at best. And the problem with that, and I agree with you, is that if you go to a two-year school and you spend much of that time getting to where you should have been in the first place, how could you possibly prepare yourself to go get a job or for something else? It's really it's as if an employer is, you know, looking at resumes of people who have a high school education, even though they've been in community college. Now, the other thing is, and you pointed this out, community college is relatively inexpensive. And I think you said 71% of people or something close to that could afford the cost of what they were doing in the first place. So it's not as if you're helping that many more people. You're just kind of transferring a cost onto the taxpayer. And as you've rightfully pointed out, you're transferring a cost that in the end, when people drop out or don't complete the program, is a wasted cost.
Well, right, and it's a lot more expensive to deliver these courses in higher education than it is in the K through 12 system. I think this is essentially the president proposing a 13th and 14th grade for our K through 12 system, and that's not going to address the problem. You mentioned employers. I think it's important to look at the employer's perspective as well. There are many employers who state that they want someone with a four-year or two-year college degree, not because the job necessarily even requires it. You know, you often hear it said that you need more than a high school diploma to succeed in many jobs today, and that's in many cases true. But it doesn't necessarily need to be a two- or four-year degree for a couple of reasons. One is because for many employers, requiring a certain degree for a job is often more about making sure they have someone who showed enough determination and persistence to get through the education, not that they necessarily learned something in college that would be relevant to the job. We all know about the people with bachelor's degrees or higher who are baristas at Starbucks or what have you. But the other issue is, it doesn't necessarily have to be a full degree. There are so many people out there with some college but no degree. They're looking for a way to prove what they know how to do. Many people want to go get their college education in chunks and go back every once in a while. So there needs to be more of an emphasis, as there is in technical fields and a lot of the trades, but also high-tech computer industries, of a focus on incremental credentials, so earning credentials that are specifically validated and valued by the employers out there, because they are the ones who know the skills and competencies needed to actually be successful in the job. So along the way, while you're working towards earning a degree, it would make sense to earn what are sometimes called stackable credentials that are externally validated and can provide workers, potential employees, stepping stones on the way to a job and then a better job and then a better job than that. So I think that really needs to be part of this conversation too.
Michael, this is John. I think there's an extremely high risk here in that we have another situation where we have a very important segment of society, education, that is becoming a political pawn, versus, in other words, we're taking political versus pragmatic approaches to how to be a better country. Clearly, as per the conversation I was having when you were coming in, you know, there is an absolute connection between the quality of education of your citizenry and the success of your country. However, we are sitting here now with a country where we have actually a lot of people who are overeducated and don't necessarily have jobs waiting for them, while we are importing illegally a significant workforce to do basic foundational skills. And this could be anything from plumbing, masonry, sheetrocking, and building trades, and landscaping, and other things. And this is where I see huge opportunity here, that the the interim college, the public 2-year schools, could actually serve as a way of rising these people up by giving them basic career skills and enough communication skills to be able to actually make a living and provide for their family. They don't necessarily need the advanced degree. And the problem I have is if you do not allow for the private sector to come up with creative ways to solve this problem, I think it becomes just another, use the term stepping stone, I would say yet another stepping stone to big government socialism that's very difficult to recover from.
Well, yeah, and as we've discussed, I think we're in agreement this is more about politics and than it is about policy, and it's showing because you're not seeing a lot of movement on this at all on the Hill from either party. This is something that I think, let's look back just a few months back to the November elections when Republicans took over both houses of Congress, and there was a little bit of hope that maybe the two sides could come together on a few issues and actually work together. And I think those dreams were kind of dashed when the president put out his State of the Union address, because really there was not a whole lot in there that the two sides could have worked together on. It was more of political posturing, I think, like this free community college proposal, but also many other proposals that were more demands to Congress rather than kind of reaching a hand out and offering to work together in any substantive way, at least.
I think that's a very good point. I would follow up with that by saying, while I'm a big fan of a simplified tax policy, I think the convoluted nature of our tax code, the only real people who benefit are those who make a lot of money on K Street. But even that being said, you could even use tax credits with companies who, essentially bring people on and sort of, some form of educational indentured servitude, so that the people are still ultimately responsible for paying back, but that the opportunity barriers are removed. So there are, I think, innovative ways of doing this. But I wanted to compare this and get your opinion on where I see the big failure is. I look at something like public housing. Property rights is a foundation of what made this country and our basic American experiment, if you will, successful. But public housing, when you just hand things to people, we have seen endless public housing projects that became nothing more than dilapidated failures, and many were knocked down, versus Habitat for Humanity, which actually has been quite successful. And I think if you apply that to education, if the private sector is involved, you can be darn sure that there's going to be merit on the front end and there's going to be a level of efficacy on the back end. If the public is involved, I just imagine this being the educational version of public housing, and the last thing we need is our educational system to also become a dilapidated failure.
Well, Ryan, I think it's easy to oversimplify it a little, but I agree on the whole that there's certainly benefits in the education system when there are market forces that are brought to bear, when it's not just government telling you where you can educate your child and you really not having any other choice beyond that. I think there's absolutely something to be said for market competition, and I think there's some also really innovative ideas out there that get beyond the idea of a school must look today like it did 100 years ago. There are so many other options out there for getting a good education, and I think it's important to try different things and look at different ways that we can educate kids and make sure that parents are the ones in the driver's seat to find out which of these options is right for them. But we need to be careful. I mean, there needs to be accountability as well. There needs to be, like in any free market, there needs to be high-quality information out there for parents to make informed decisions. And we need to make sure that we're not just assuming a charter school is better than a public school, or a private school is better than a charter school, or something along those lines. There are many outstanding public schools out there. There are many not very good public schools out there, and the same could be said of private and charter and any other type of school out there. So really, I think the focus should be on quality, making sure there is transparency and accountability in the system, and ultimately letting parents choose not just what somebody tells them is the best option, but what it happens to be the best option for their individual child and their individual child's needs.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said all that, and I agree with that completely. And I also feel that markets are a great place to resolve some of these issues. Michael, I just wanted to point out something. I've been looking into doing another master's, and I'm looking at all different types of schools, some I've never even heard of. And the expense is quite large. I mean, it's really troublesome if you think about it. When you look at programs that could be $50,000 to $80,000, now, I understand undergraduate level work is less expensive, but it's still a significant cost, and you want to ensure that you're getting the most out of you know, what you're putting into it. But in this case, it's taxpayer dollars that are online for the original conversation we were having. But I want to, again, go back to also the preparation of our high school students. And I do truly believe that a lot of the politics that has become involved in our educational system in what would be really a top-down flow has created a path that limits the potential of what the teachers could do in the high school level, which has an impact, as we've all said, in college. And I just want to give a few examples. I have been paying close attention to what's going on with the testing that's going on in the high schools right now. And what I've been told by teachers is that they're having to spend a lot of time preparing and going over the exams themselves, and then the actual administration of the exam is at least a week, if not more. So you're taking a lot of time away from the time that was being used by these teachers for, say, science and math, language arts, and other things which we are lacking in when you compare our country to the standards of some of the others that we are competing with in the marketplace. And I think that in none of these proposals, whether it be Common Core or the president's proposal, address the idea of really being able to compete and be efficient in how we administer the systems that educate our students. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think that's certainly true of the president's proposal. A couple things on testing and Common Core, since you bring it up. On testing, certainly there is such a thing as testing overkill.
Right.
Testing serves a purpose. There are some people out there who are saying we need to not have testing or opt kids out of testing. And I don't know why you would want to do that. I don't know why you wouldn't want to know whether or not and to what extent your child is succeeding in school, and why you wouldn't want to know whether schools as a whole or school systems as a whole are succeeding and where they may have deficiencies and what could be done about that. So I think, as I said before, transparency is an absolute must in the education system. But that doesn't mean we need to be spending so much time. I think actually, despite kind of the popular narrative out there, especially coming from the left, the reality has been that most, and there are studies to back this up, most testing is actually not driven by the state level, but is actually driven by the local level. And I think part of the reason for that is local schools have found that the state-mandated tests are, in the past, have not been terribly useful for teachers. They take too long to grade. They're not they're clunky. They don't give them real granular information about what they can do to actually help kids do better. And so because the state mandated test is let's just call it useless in many states, local school districts have opted to layer additional tests on top of that they actually think might be useful. So I think what you might see with some of these new tests out there, the PARC and the Smarter Balanced and others that are being developed, you'll actually see a reduction at the local level if those tests, the promise of those tests comes to bear, because I don't think you'll see as much of a need at the local level to layer on those additional tests on top of it if the test is better.
Right.
And there are signs that the new tests will be better. With regard to Common Core or standards in general, I think it does get to this point of We want students who are graduating from high school to be ready for college or a career or some other productive endeavor that they choose, and not, you know, that we're simply passing them out of high school to send them on their way, and then they have to go take all these expensive remedial courses in college, or private employers have to pay to train workers not with workplace skills but with basic English and math skills. That's a huge problem that we see out there, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed, like we discussed at the outset, in the K-12 system. And that's, there are so many things that need to be done to make sure we actually achieve high expectations. But first, we actually have to set high expectations. And for too long, it was the politically easy thing to do, to say we're going to set low expectations. We're going to tell parents that everything's A-okay, that 80% of the kids are proficient, when in reality it's probably 30-something percent. And that's really not doing anybody any good. And I think one of the things that that Common Core has brought about in a positive way is created a more honest accounting of whether or not students are actually performing on the whole.
Right.
Now, of course, if states want to go with something different than Common Core, that is absolutely their right. There's some people out there saying it's a federal mandate. It's not. So if states want to change Common Core, that's completely their right. My only hope is that if they make changes, make them better and don't make it worse. And some states have, in kind of mucking around with this, have made the standards worse and not better. So that's not what we want to see.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, Michael Brickman, again, I want to thank you for this conversation. We'll have to pick this up again sometime. And we did appreciate your story, Let's Get Serious About College Readiness, that was featured in The Hill. Again, Michael is the National Policy Director with the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, and we thank you for joining us today on the Final Say Radio Show. Look forward to having you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the discussion.
Okay, take care. Well, we're busy show as always, and without further ado, we're going to jump right into our next guest, who joins us every Tuesday afternoon. And Jim, it's great to have you. James S. Robbins, expert on national security and so much more. And Jim, how is it this week?
Oh, well, it's really interesting. I guess, like you, I've been following the election in Israel, waiting for the polls to close. That happens at 4 p.m. Eastern. And then we will get to hear the latest exit poll results. And then they start the counting and the bargaining.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I've got it open right now. I was reading it, reading as much as I can about what's going on with the election as we're doing this in all, you know, through the morning. And some interesting things. I noticed comments of potential left-wing groups busing in as many Arabs as they can to try to get Bibi out of office. it's interesting to me, Jim, because I think that at some point, especially when it comes to Israel, politics aside, there's no more critical thing than defense and national security. I mean, I can't think of another country where it's so vital or more vital than for Israel. And it seems like our president and administration have done everything they can to get rid of him or to change Israel to just get in line with their, whatever they have going on with making Iran the hegemony in that region. But it's troublesome, and I really hope that he does pull through in this, because it would be, I think, devastating if he doesn't.
Well, if anything, the Obama administration has helped because of national security. I don't think anybody in Israel thinks that they would have a better national security president or prime minister than Netanyahu. If he's having a problem, and he appears to be, then it isn't because of that. It's because of domestic issues, the economy, and so forth. But so far as national security is concerned, to the extent that President Obama has offered a contrast to Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's definitely helped him out. We will see, though. I was interested in a graph I saw in The Independent that broke down the race, showing Labor having, I think it was 26 seats against 22 for Likud. But when you add in the left-leaning parties and right-leaning parties to each side, the right side of the scale had more. So that might, and the kingmakers then in the middle would be the Orthodox parties and the Arabs, the Arab parties, which for the first time have banded together. So it would be interesting to see who's going to be the kingmaker. Is it going to be this Union of Arab Parties, or is it going to be the Orthodox parties? Should be interesting.
You know, there's a fascinating parallel, Jim, if you want to compare all the similarities between Israel, Israelis, how they live in the U.S., right? We're very similar countries, very similar, except for the fact that we have a Republican and they have a parliamentary form of government. But there's a similar problem that you have is we have a two-party system. The third party becomes almost a guaranteed failure. In fact, typically the Green Party, for example, would almost guarantee a loss of the Democrats, whereas the Ross Perot incident showed very clearly how another conservative party would clearly guarantee the Democrats would win. And so what we have is we tend to have a bipolar system where the irrational actors, the far right and the far left, have an excessive amount of power within that party, which makes us a very polarized country. Israel suffers from a very similar thing. The difference is those irrational actors, and maybe that's an unfair characterization, but I'll just leave it at that. These are the people who take an extreme left or an extreme right position, but because they are almost always needed in order for the president, who, as you know, holds very little actual power in the Israeli government, except when it comes to forming a government where he actually becomes like, you know, something akin to the ultimate arbiter and authority who helps to coordinate that, the one with the highest number of votes in a lead. So that was a very interesting parallel to connect, and I wanted to specifically tie that in and get your opinion that with that as a backdrop, how unbelievably unfair is it that Obama and all of his many Democratic minion cronies who railed against Netanyahu trying to protect his country by making a speech here, at the same time have had numbers upwards of 1,600 of their operatives on the ground in Israel trying to guarantee that Netanyahu will not be reelected. So very, very interesting. I want to get your take on that.
Well, it is interesting because imagine if that was going on in this country. Imagine if some foreign country like China or Russia or, you name it, it could be anybody, some country with a lot of political interests and a lot of money and organizing skill and people sent teams of folks over here to hit the ground, to community organize, to do whatever on behalf of one candidate or specifically against a candidate. Imagine if that was happening in one of our presidential elections. What would we do? I mean, I think people in this country would flip out if they knew that some other country with a foreign policy contention with our current president or maybe a supporter of our current president decided, you know what, let's go there and help that guy. Well, it's illegal, in fact. It would be illegal if it was that blatant in this country. You can't have foreign money. Well, you have to run that by the Clinton Foundation about foreign money. That's another topic. But, I mean, just imagine if it was going on here. People would lose it. And so I think when the Senate looks into this, which they're going to, and finds the connections to the White House, if there are any, or at least to see how explicit they are, people in Israel will have pretty good reason to be upset about this. And I think people in this country should be upset to think that we were doing that in another friendly, democratic country. I mean, it's one thing to have a coup in an unfriendly country, you know, that kind of thing. But we're talking about manipulating an election in a friendly foreign country. That really should be off limits for us. And if it was done here, I mean, you can just imagine. I mean, imagine a president being elected and then later it coming out that the only reason the guy got in power was because a foreign country made sure of it. Can you imagine? I mean, would that guy have any legitimacy whatsoever to run this country? I don't think so.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Jim, you can make the argument that there's a lot of outside foreign influence because of money flowing into business transactions, foundations, or even campaigns. I mean, I could tell you, when I looked at the reports for the Obama campaigns when he ran for president both times, there were a lot of foreign addresses and a lot of foreign names and big dollar amounts. Now, who's to say that they weren't, you know, just, you know, living overseas? But, you know, who's checking in each and every one of them to say that no foreign influence was done there? And again, you know, John brings up an interesting point as he's sending me a little message, and he's right. You know, we have a lot of friends like France and the United Kingdom and Canada, and we don't, you know, participate in regime change in those countries, and nor should we. And quite frankly, it would really devastate the relationship that you have with a country. And again, we've discussed with you many times with regards to foreign policy. Sometimes we make decisions that create problems down the road for relationships we have. We see it right now with our friends in Egypt and other places. You know, we make mistakes, but to actually try to influence the elections in a foreign country is, I think, an absolute no-no, unless, of course, it's like Iran, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind influencing some regime change in Iran. That would be wonderful. There are cases to be made for it on national security grounds.
Yes.
You know, other reasons. There is no case to be made for it when you have a country like Israel just because President Obama has a personal antipathy for Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, at the very least, it's an abuse of power. You know, at the most, it's something worse. So hopefully it's not as bad as we think. I guess the Senate in its investigation will come up with some answers on that. But you rightly point out that, yes, it is possible for foreign money to influence our elections. There are loopholes in the election financing laws that allow Americans overseas to funnel money in, but who's to say whether they are actually Americans and who's to say where that money's coming from? And that's a huge loophole that hopefully can be closed. I remember seeing something about the 2008 election and money flowing in from Gaza to the Obama campaign. I don't know if anyone ever really fully looked into that or not, but seemed a little strange to me. Is there this huge expatriate population living in Gaza of American expatriates who really, really want Barack Obama to be president? You know, that never got a lot of attention from the FEC or Congress. Of course, at the time, neither of those bodies would be very interested in looking too deeply into that, I'm sure.
But it's never that difficult to connect the dots, especially if you start adding in players like the Muslim Brotherhood, Qatar, Turkey, et cetera. Jim, last night I was at a fabulous event, if you're familiar with the Financial Policy Council based in New York City, which takes the unusual position of focusing 100% as a think tank on the connection between foreign policy and between basically American capitalism, right, and why it's so critical that we stop running away from what made us great. The guest speaker at the event last night was Lisa Daftari, a Fox News award-winning journalist. And, you know, she's, for our listeners who aren't aware, she's of Iranian descent herself, born in America. Their parents, around the time of the overthrow of the Shah, were actually students here in the U.S., and of course, logically, like many people who now usually refer to themselves as Persian, you know, decide to stay. But I wanted to bring up an interesting connection to the transition from discussing Israel to discussing Iran. One of the common threads that I think we have to deal with in this country that Israel does as well is the fact that we very often are voting on national policies or on domestic policies and not necessarily voting on foreign policy. And I think that's a particularly interesting case because almost universally, Netanyahu is seen as one of the strongest leaders to protect Israel against Iran, for example. But I've had many good friends, including many conservative friends, who've told me that he's deemed by very few to be a very effective leader on national or domestic policies. And I think this is a very interesting dynamic because, again, if you compare it to the U.S., as I've said during prior interviews of ours, sometimes I think if you were restructuring the Constitution, you should have a president and a vice president where one is responsible for domestic and one is responsible for foreign, because I'm much more concerned about my president making sure we're safe against the world and not necessarily trying to be the executive manager of every little minutia that occurs within our borders. I think private industry mostly can handle that. Certainly the governors can.
Well, I think so. I don't know which of those two I would like Joe Biden to be in charge of, however. Maybe domestic, because I think that he would just his limitations would keep him in check. You know what I mean? Like, actually, a guy that incompetent, it would be more useful to have him on domestic, because he wouldn't be able to do much. Whereas if he was on foreign, that would really be bad. You know, like Joe Biden could really screw up our foreign.
Well, absolutely. But following your logic, Jim, you would say the president would never have been elected if it was about foreign policy. He would never be sitting in that empty chair.
That's a good question.
Barack Obama. Well, I don't know. Of course, the 2008 election was all about the economic crisis that we were in the middle of, and hope and change and fundamental transformation and, you know, making history and all that junk. Americans rarely vote on foreign policy, and of course that's a difference between the U.S. and Israel, where national security is critical. There are some elections where foreign policy plays a huge role, of course, like 1980 is a fantastic example. But the problem is that usually foreign policy only plays a huge role when there's a crisis, when things are going wrong. And when things are going somewhat okay or something overshadows foreign policy, then you get people elected like Mr. Obama who just really don't know what they're doing. And he really doesn't. There are no foreign policy successes of this administration. I know when Hillary Clinton retired from state, they were trumpeting how she championed our opening to Burma. It's like my favorite example. That's all I could think of that she ever did. You know, she opened us up to Burma, to the junta of Burma, right? But other than that, what have they done that has helped our country? And I really don't see anything overseas that has helped. Killing bin Laden, okay, fine. But you know what? That would have happened anyway, whoever was president. It might have even happened sooner because a more bold president would not have scrubbed the mission a couple of times like our current president did. So other than that, I don't know, maybe you can think of some examples, but I can think of a ton of examples of where we have been hurt overseas by President Obama, and that's just going to come to visit us in a series of much bigger crises for the next president to deal with.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's significantly made mistakes with all the big power players around the world. And yes, I'll refer to Iran as one of them, but he's failed horribly with regards to Russia. He's made huge mistakes with China, and those are three that are big enough that could lead to conflicts either, you know, through use of other nation states or with them themselves. So it's very troubling. Jim, I wanted to switch gears a little bit here. I'm looking at the letter from the senators, Tom Cotton and others, 47, that was sent to Tehran with regards to I'm not so concerned with the content of what they said, because I don't think that matters as much as that they did this, and the response from, if you heard John Kerry out there, you know, talking about how terrible it was that they did this and that they're interfering with negotiations and whatnot, and this is unprecedented. But the fact is, in my opinion, the way the United States has been negotiating against themselves, this administration has not been transparent at all. And in fact, you know, I don't understand how you set a timeline and you set a limitation of what you're willing to put forth. And then that timeline comes and you say, well, we'll tell you what, we'll continue speaking with you for another 3 months, but we'll give you more. We're going to raise the amount of what we're offering. And they keep doing that. What has Iran sacrificed outside of time? And, well, really nothing, because they've continued to develop their program and skirt the international system through restricting the locations that the inspectors and others could even go to and ensure that they're even meeting any of the things that have been established over time. So I think that should be addressed, not what the content was of the letter by these senators, because we're missing the big picture, or at least the administration is.
Oh, sure. And now the issues are, one is, are they going to extend the timeline from March 24th to March 31st? That's the first extension. The other question is, will they extend it to May 31st? And then there's another proposal to extend it even further, and that the big announcement that they're going to come up with shortly will not be that a deal has been made, but which actually is probably good because it would be a bad deal, but that enough progress has been made to keep talking. That's what they've said the last three times they did this, and they keep kicking the can down the road. I think from the Iranian point of view, it's probably great to not have a deal because they can continue on the way they have been. They can continue working on their nuclear program, and they can continue being engaged. So what that means is that the Obama administration is not going to do anything more to them, that Obama is going to stand in the way of further sanctions or any type of action at all against Iran in order to not disrupt the negotiations. So in that way, negotiating itself becomes a weapon of the Iranians to continue with their program. I mean, that becomes their current form of continuing the dispute. Endless negotiations. We've seen this from, like, North Korea, for example, that is very good at doing this, keeping us in sort of these endless rounds of talks that go on until they get the bomb. Well, maybe that's what the Iranians are doing. It certainly doesn't seem like they're not doing that, because if they truly didn't want a nuclear weapon, it would seem to me to be very easy to conclude a nuclear agreement with them. But now not only are they saying that they want to keep more and more centrifuges, and of course that number keeps going up, but they previously agreed to point in the negotiation of certain centrifuges that they have at an underground facility that primarily would be used for making weaponized uranium. And before they were going to get rid of them or use them only for research, now they say they want to keep all of them and be able to use them in an unrestricted way. So tell me again how we're actually negotiating anything with them. It seems to me that we're just giving ground, giving ground, giving ground. And in the end, they will wind up with a deal where they get to do whatever they want and we get rid of sanctions.
Yep, and that was my point. And I want to add to what you said on North Korea, because I wanted to jump in on that as well. If you go back to the 90s when all that was going down, most of that was the Clinton administration. And what really troubled me with that is that they looked at that as, we're going to negotiate, Madeleine Albright and others, we're going to negotiate with North Korea and come to this. And next thing you know, 10, 12 years later, there's a detonation and oops, they have the bomb. And I think there's precedence of what happens when you don't properly deal with these issues. And for either Secretary Kerry or Barack Obama or anyone else with his administration to make statements, one thing we could assure you is that we will not let them get the bomb. I'm not assured of anything by this administration outside of the fact that they could spend money like drunken sailors, and that's about it. But I can assure you one thing. You give somebody enough rope and you give them enough time, they will accomplish their goals, and that's where we're headed, period. I mean, so Netanyahu is right. There's a line there that can't be crossed, and I think we're already there, personally.
Oh, I completely agree. They cross that, they're getting closer and closer to that line all the time. We know that the North Koreans helped them with their nuclear program, and why not follow the North Korean model? If the country, like the poorest country in the world, with absolutely no reason to have these weapons whatsoever, can do it, then any country can do it. That's what North Korea tells us. So any country that wants to do it should follow the North Korean model.
Right. This is the North Korea that's pitch dark when you look at it at night on a satellite. It's such a vast, backwards country. Jim, I wanted to make a kind of my closing commentary on this particular subject, which is that its intent is what's most important. Iran has made its intent when you have your supreme leader, who's not a commander-in-chief, he is a supreme leader, the equivalent of a Hitler, for example, makes and uses repetitively terms like annihilating another country, like nuclear genocide. You know what their intent is. There is no need to have all of this infrastructure in place simply for nuclear power. South Korea has 23 operating reactors, which is a significant, almost 30% of the country's consumption. They don't have nuclear bombs, and they don't have the infrastructure in place to build them. And quite frankly, it's to an advantage to them. Why? Because the cost of doing this and the cost of the waste of products and the security and everything else that goes into that is heavy enough for the power plants alone, let alone all the production and the shipping facilities. And so they look to countries like us to provide that fissile material. And I think that's a critically important part of this, which is absent from the entirety of these negotiations, is intent. And by the way, I've been seeing more and more coming out of the French, you know, where major leaders are starting to leak out that the French, you know, as socialist as they are, making clear they just like they don't like Netanyahu any more than Obama does, but they believe on Iran, Netanyahu's right. They don't trust Iran, and worse than that, they don't trust that our president will deal effectively with Iran.
Well, that's very smart, because no, he won't deal effectively with Iran. There won't be a sufficient verification regime put in place in order to check up on what they're doing. And when you look at Iran having an organic uranium processing capability, why do they even need that to have nuclear power? I mean, if nuclear power is what they want, why not have a deal structured so that other countries process the uranium for them and give it to them? Or sell it to them, or, you know, somehow it is provided to them in a way where there's no danger of them making weapons out of the stuff. These things can be done, but that, so far as I know, that hasn't entered the discussion whatsoever. It's all about seeding ground on the capabilities of Iran to retain its weapons-making ability. And, oh, by the way, this discussion doesn't even go into their long-range missile program. You know, they're developing ICBMs that can reach us. It doesn't even talk about the fact that they're developing warheads for their missiles that can only be used to mount nuclear weapons on missiles. I mean, that's the only thing that these warheads are being used for or could be used for. And this was discovered by the United Nations inspectors. So it's not like it was, you know, something that came out of Israel or something that came out of, you know, the right wing of the United States. This was the UN.
That's a good point. And, you know, again, we've discussed this, Jim. If Iran continues on this path and you're looking at an escalation and increase in those types of weapon systems by the other countries in that region, and then you have an escalation and increased chance of something tragic happening. And I think it's best that the international community does the best they can to stop this program. And Kerry, I think, was irresponsible in saying, well, you guys want to, you know, increase sanctions, but our partners, you know, Britain, France, China, and Germany and Russia won't go along with that. I disagree. I think those countries in some way have no choice but to act responsibly. And Russia, regardless if they're making money off the Iranians by providing a lot of the infrastructure, you know, they even have to have some common sense when it comes to these types of dealings. Jim, we have about 30 seconds for a response.
Well, I really don't care what other countries don't want to go along with it. We should show some leadership. We should do it. Maybe they'll follow. Kerry should spend less time leading from behind and try leading from the front for a change. We can have a lot of influence through sanctions and through shaping them in a smart way. It doesn't matter if other countries want to get in on it. If they do, great, even better. But if not, that doesn't mean that we should just follow them and give Iran what they want.
Absolutely. And I thought the sanctions were working, and Iran has made it a lot of gains, since we let up on those sanctions. Jim, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you so much. Have a great week, and we look forward to having you again next week. Take care.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Well, quickest show, quickest hour in radio. Again, I want to thank our two guests today, Michael Brickman for the National Policy Director, Thomas Fordham Institute, and James S. Robbins, the well-known author, writer, and expert in so many areas from defense, national security, and pretty much any domestic issue. Thank you, as always, for joining us, and we'll be back again tomorrow. Hope you enjoyed the program today. Good luck, Benjamin Netanyahu. We're rooting for you. We'll be back again every day, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Good afternoon, folks. That's a wrap.
Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcasts, go to www.thefinalsay.com.